Everybody knows Max. Yay.
Thank you so much. Okay.
You're welcome.
Want to start with this. Edmonton is located within Treaty 6 territory and within the Métis homelands. I would like to gratefully acknowledge that I live and work on lands that were the traditional home of many First Nations, such as the Cree, the Dene, the Stoney, the Saulteaux, and the Blackfoot. This past week, a neighborhood in Edmonton was renamed in the Cree language to Wequintowin. Wequintowin. It means circle of friends. So, to all of you who are attending today on behalf of the Sufi Circle of Canada, welcome to today's Circle of Friends. So, I've prepared a story about our journey toward the living altar under the guidance and scrutiny of Pir Murshid Hidayat Inayat Khan and his beloved Murshida Aziza. I just want to say that this is a work in progress. I seem to add to it every day, so hopefully I can get through it all with leaving a little bit of time for us to have a discussion afterwards. It's a story, but it's not the story about the evolution of the universal worship. I really do appreciate Moinuddin, this opportunity to tell the story, and it emanates from our Sufi retreats at Lake O'Hara in the 1980s and the 1990s. So all forms of worship or belief should draw man closer to God. And there are many ways and means to strive towards this goal. And it came to me that we learned the universal worship was not just a service, but it is also a spiritual practice. I want to add this, and this is one of the recent additions I made to this, meeting ground of the divine mind. The experience of individuals' thoughts, feelings, and knowledge of individuals and the experience of nations, races throughout all ages and periods of history have not belonged only to individuals, not even to the multitude, to the nations, the races, but have always gone back till they came to that depth where they were assimilated in what is called the divine mind. And this was inspired by last week's Divine Dervish Cafe presentation by Murshida Nuria. So the universal worship. I'm sort of going over things. Some things here people will know actually quite well, and others may not be as familiar. So I'm going to probably provide a fairly cursory view of the overall picture of the universal worship. So it's the religious activity of the Sufi movement, and it's called the universal worship, or it's called also the Church of All. And why is it named? It's named that because it contains all different ways of worship in all churches. So this is where I bring in. It is the meeting ground of the divine mind. Universal worship, which has been organized in the Sufi movement, was the hope of all prophets, prayers, desire of all great souls, that the light given in all the different forms, such as the Buddhist scriptures, the Quran, the Bible, or the teachings of Krishna or Zarathustra, should be known by everyone. And the work of the Sufi message is to spread the unity of religion. So the prayer Salat, may the message of God reach far and wide. This, I learned a lot, and she's with us today, Kuan Yin Pujos Michelle in Banff. She has done a lot of research into an early Murid, Nargis Jesse Dowland. And Nargis wrote a book, and there's a picture of it here called The Way of Return, and that's a picture of Nargis. So from 1921 to 33, Nargis managed the impressive Polygon House Hotel, where it's believed she first came to meet Inayat Khan on one of his lecture tours. We know that she was initiated into the Sufi order, or the Sufi movement at the time, in 1919. And she was fairly elderly at the time as well, 53, by Inayat Khan, who became her beloved Murshid. Inayat Khan later named her a Khalifa and a national representative of the Sufi movement in England, an honor she held from 1921 to 1933. And she gave her He gave her the Persian name Nargis, and that means inspired soul whose heart is focused on the spirit of guidance. So this caused me to wonder, well, what was the Polygon Hotel? And so I researched it a bit, and there's a bit of a history behind it, but here's a picture of it in 1934, and I presume it was pretty much the same in 1921. It appears that an icon must have lectured there. I imagine a hotel like this would have a ballroom or a meeting room where he would have given his Sufi lecture. And Nargis met him there, and things evolved from that point. And just another picture while I'm at it here, the first universal worship was held at this house. It's rather grand though, isn't it? And it's in London, and I'll mention it a little bit later. I just thought it was very interesting to sort of imagine the world that they were living in at the time in the 1920s. So Nargis, apart from her energetic support of Vinayak Khan and the fledgling Order of England, her special contribution was most evident in two areas, the genesis of the Universal Worship Service and in publication efforts. She published a number of documents on the Sufi message. And this is from her notebook. Once when Murshid, and she's speaking for herself in the third person here, I think. Once when Murshid was standing with Miss Dowland before a dilapidated old church, she said to him, "Oh, Murshid, shouldn't we buy this and rebuild it for the Sufis?" Well, Murshid answered, "Never," adamantly, "never, never, never will Murshid found a church." A week later, Murshid dictated to her at her flat in Southampton the service of the universal worship. It was then and there that the Church of All came into existence. And Sharif Munir Graham has written about the first universal worship. And he tells us that the service was held at the home of Gladys I. Lloyd on Saturday, May the 7th, 1921. And that was the picture of that house I just showed you. So here's a bit of information about the first universal worship. And Shabazz E.A. Mitchell was a professional journalist who, from Southampton, they would have traveled to London. He described the service. Murshid stands facing his murids, and Miss Dowland, the national representative on his left hand, begins to read the prayers in a calm, strong voice. As she reads, Murshid, with closed eyes, makes gently and with deliberation the appropriate gestures, his movements being watched by all with indescribable emotion. The prayers themselves are the most comprehensive we have ever listened to. They lift the thoughts to things above and turn them on things beneath. So this is the first impression that I ever had that the prayer movements were ever used in the, and this may be the first public use of the prayer movements as well in the universal worship. Graham adds, the fact that Murshid himself performed the gestures as Nargis Dowland recited the prayers shows that he felt the movements were most important. And Murshid commented at the time, the body of the movement is formed today. The first universal worship is, there's more coverage of it on the website called theuniversalworship.org. Okay, this is how it was described. And this is, I think it's very interesting to imagine what the context of all of this was at the time. One is invited into the room on the first floor. As the doors open, one's eyes first catch light of a lighted candle and the smoke of burning incense upon an improvised altar. The prayers, speaking of greatness, the power, the beauty, the all-pervadingness of God, also of his messengers, Rama, Krishna, Buddha, Abraham, Zoroaster, Moses, Jesus, Muhammad, and those names who are unknown. We hold our breath, realizing it to be a moment of profound significance. And when that little company disperses to pass into the night, the thought in one's mind is that there has just been planted a tiny seed, which will shall one day spring up into a great tree whose leaves shall be for the healing of the nations. So that tiny seed led to a great tree, and one branch of that tree was our time at Lake O'Hara and the development of the Living Altar. So I just want to talk a little bit about the gestures. This is an icon speaking at a collective interview in 1926. I would like today to explain the meaning of the different gestures we make in our elevation service, for every movement has a meaning. It must be understood that a prayer is not offered to God in order to give him the pleasure, but the prayer is offered to God in order to lift up the soul. If the prayer is only in the feeling, it is not yet expressed. If the prayer is put in the thought, then it has gone one step further in expression. When the prayer is in words, it has taken two steps in expression. If the prayer is in movements, then it has taken three steps. That makes the prayer expressed fully. And it's a bit along this line, I think, that Hedayat was guiding us with the living altar. So I just wanted to show these images that we prepared. This was part of the work that we did at Lake O'Hara. The gestures are, I'm thinking, are very well described in the historical documents. So I did some pictures of them, and we can imagine that this is what an icon would have been gesturing. His movements would have been in that first universal worship service. So for those who are not particularly familiar with an icon family, because I'm going to talk a little bit about Hedayat. This is the family. It's a portrait of the family. One of the companions is missing. The three companions were Mahbub Khan, the eldest brother of Inayat Khan, Murshid Ali Khan, who was his cousin, sometimes referred to as his brother, and Musharraf Khan, who was his youngest brother. And I'm not too sure which two these are. I thought maybe it's Ali Khan who's missing, but I'm not too sure. Of course, here we go on. We've got Noor and Lisa. We've got Claire, Hedayat, and Pir Vilayat with their mother and father. So Hedayat attended every Lake O'Hara service, every Lake O'Hara retreat, between 1981 and 2002, with Aziza. And this is just some early pictures of him being blessed by his father, and Inayat Khan himself. Hedayat was about nine, I think, when his father died. So I'm paying tribute, all of us at Lake O'Hara, of course, pay tribute to Murshid Hedayat at Lake O'Hara. Here's just a picture of Hedayat. It's actually an image by Fazl Nisa. I didn't write it in here, but it's Fazl Nisa. Carol Harmon is her image. And then a group of us at one of our retreats, I couldn't tell you exactly which year that was, you'll probably, some of you are going to start recognize some of these faces. And of course, on the left, in the middle left, is Hedayat and Aziza. So Lake O'Hara was an era of study and exploration. Hedayat was adamant about preserving the authentic legacy of his father, but at the same time encouraged us to explore and experiment with the expression of the Sufi message. You can see him gathering, having the children gathered around him at our early retreats when we all had young children attending. But the other images depict some of the experimentation that we did with the Zarat ceremony, and with the elements, and we acted out. And Inayat Khan wrote plays and was very much supportive of theatrical presentations. So it brings to life these ceremonies and practices that that we've all learned about. This is a recollection While attending a Lake O'Hara retreat in the early 1980s, Hedayat told us of a recollection he had from his father of his father. Inayat Khan told Hedayat that he imagined a pyramid solidifying over the universal worship altar during the service. But in his lifetime, Inayat never had a chance to explore this vision. So Hedayat asked us, sort of the core group at Lake O'Hara, to explore what could this possibly have meant. And at that time, the retreat was very well attended, 60 people, but a number of them from Eastern Canada. And this particular crystal, and I looked it up on the internet, it's called an octahedron shape, and it's normally formed in fluoride and in diamonds, was given to me by one of the attendees from Toronto. And it was always an inspiration in terms of imagining this sacred geometry. So I want to talk a little bit about Inayat Khan's his thoughts on symbolism. I'll read it. The wise have given lessons to the world in different forms suited to the evolution of the people at a particular time. And the first and most original form of education that the wise gave to the world has been symbolical. This method of teaching has been valued in all ages and will always have its importance. That is not beauty which is not veiled. In the veiling and unveiling of beauty is the purpose of life. Beauty is that which is always out of reach. You see it and you do not see it. You touch it and you cannot touch it. It is seen and yet veiled. It is known and yet unknown. And therefore, words are often inadequate to express the beauty of truth. Therefore, symbolism is adopted by the wise. And it is symbolic language that allowed us to pursue the incredible mystery behind the universal worship and the effectiveness. So I also want to talk a little bit Inayat Khan's thought on geometry. Now, he didn't have a chance to explore what Hedayat asked us to explore from a geometrical point of view of the universal worship, but he was very interested in geometry, as we've learned. Geometry is an important means to express symbolism. And Inayat Khan was particularly intrigued by, for instance, the pentagram. And I don't know that this is particularly well documented. I haven't found anything so far, but about why the pentagram, except that it is actually a universal symbol, which is reflected in the screens of his darga. So I show the picture of the darga, and all of the screens are based on the geometry of the pentagram. So Hedayat got quite excited at the prospect of pursuing a geometrical symbolism of the universal worship. So this is the start of the geometrical exploration. A pyramid is one of the earliest known symbolical figures, and the great pyramids of the ancient Egyptians are an example. It's suggested that to the Egyptians, the pyramids represented the known world, the northern hemisphere at the time, with very precise dimensional calculations. And this is the lasting power of such an important symbol. Regarding the universal worship service, we went about trying to figure out what was turning out to be not easily explainable in words. A symbolical exploration was the only way to begin to understand an icon's vision and ultimately the meaning, purpose, and power of the universal worship service. So in 1985, we started an exploration of the sacred geometry. So I'll just go quickly through this. The dot, the most important of all figures. For every figure is an extension of the dot. It is the beginning, it is the one and all. And last week we were presented with three from the names of God. The Wazifas, Yah Wahid, is one that's very appropriate. to this particular geometrical concept, the dot. The Yawahid means the one present in the many, a vision of infinity in a grain of sand, and from one source emerging diversity. So from the dot comes the line, and the line, and from the line comes the cross. And the vertical line represents divine aspiration. The horizontal line represents material manifestation. And Yawasi is an appropriate wazifa for this, means ever expanding, ever embracing. So we have the dot, ever expanding, ever embracing. So we take that further, and from the line, from the line and the cross come the circle. And the circle symbolizes the unity of the divine and the material, and it symbolizes motion. It's the when we first begin to get the impression of motion, it's the dot is static, the cross is static, the lines are static. But now, when we have a circle, we're starting to invoke motion, circular and spiral in and out, the breath of life. From the dot and the circle came the divine geometries, the mandalas, in this case, the eight-pointed star, which is derived from two squares set at an angle to each other. The mandala is a vehicle. If one is interested in mandalas, one always imagines them as a vehicle on which the ceremony of the universal worship can travel to its destination. So this concept of movement and traveling to a destination is a very important part of the universal worship. Inside the eight-pointed star can be found a square. The vertical and horizontal lines bisect the square, symbolizing the known at the front, the unknown at the back, the seen above, and the unseen below. So we're starting to develop three dimensions here. The center of the square, the dot, represents the divine center of all things. So now we stretch this, and we go into the third dimension. The dot is located above the square. Joining the dot to the corners of the squares creates a pyramid. And here we're starting to begin to understand what an icon may have been imagining when he thought of a pyramid becoming solid, forming over the altar. The pyramid in this case, and especially when you imagine it as the crystal, which is translucent. In other words, it can transmit light. It refracts light, transforms white light, representing unity, into the rainbow, representing variety, which is the human condition. So a crystal has been formed, encompassing all aspects of the divine and the material. This crystal represents the power of transformation. It transforms single white light to the spectrum and vice versa. Thus, it is the symbol by which we can understand the all-in-one and the one in all. I just get a little bit into some of the geometrical experimentation that we did. I was on the left. We also did some geometrical exploration of the zikr. And then Hidayat, I put these down below. Hidayat really wanted us to focus on these. He was very inspired by the idea of these cones of light, which we've actually applied to the pranayama practices. But I just thought of there's some sketches we did at the time. I thought I'd put them in there. So the universal worship, this pyramidal crystal solidifying around the altar, the known above, the unknown below. And what has now we've got a symbol in motion, and the symbol takes us on a journey. We think of the universal worship as a vehicle on the journey of divine realization. So I just write here that it's amazing to me that without any effort, the geometry of the universal worship evolved exactly as the Nayak Khan taught the practice. The practice, the layout, the form of the universal worship. And so the altar is half of the square. It's the seen part. On the surface of the altar is created a crescent. And you'll see how this relates to the original drawings of how an icon wanted the altar to be, excuse me, to be laid out. for the service. But here we're following the geometry, and the geometry begins to, if we go over to the right image, begins to define a place in front of the altar that is we call it the bowl of reception. Go on to the next one here. The bowl of reception occurs at a point in front of the altar, and here we have that symbol, the pentagonal symbol, which is that universal symbol of man, of humankind, standing out with arms outstretched and feet apart, giving the blessing. So what we've found from a geometrical point is the point of where the Chirag stands in front of the altar and gives the blessing at the end of the service. But the focus of everybody, the altar, if it's the living altar, if it's the audience, it's the people in the audience, it's the focus of them on that point of reception that is like a bowl of divine connection that the Chirag steps into, and from that point gives the blessing at the end of that. For this, I think of it as sort of immaculate realization of divine connection that is really the mystery, I think, of the universal worship. In this case, in this drawing that I'm showing you here, we've got the crescent moon representing the audience. The attendees who are very much part of it. So it's an all-inclusive circle. So this is a more clear kind of demonstration of the layout of the altar when it's not a universal, when it's not a living altar, when it's a regular universal worship service. So I'll just read this. The blessing is given by the Chirag at the point of reception. The point of reception is that bowl of that is a focus of everybody when they're aware during the service. We're imagining that's building up with this energy so that that we can have this divine connection at the end. It's the symbolic container of light that is manifested during the course of the service, just as the crystal has solidified over the altar by our focus and our attention to the unifying messages of the world's religions. The moment of the blessing is a transformative experience of unity. It's a divine experience. These are pictures that I took, which reflect the original form. So in none of this does this deviate, this geometrical exploration, does it deviate at all from the original form intent of the service that was inspired by an icon. So the living altar at Lake O'Hara. The symbolic geometry informed the layout of the service, the crescent moon of the human altar, the audience in front, and the reflective crescent formation of the audience, forming a continuous and inclusive circle. So here we have all the texts and all the candles represented by humans, by people. And it was really quite special. And hopefully we'll hear from a few people as soon as I'm done about what the experience was like to be in the living altar. Each text and each candle representing the world's religious traditions is represented by a person bringing life to the light and message of the religious traditions. And the message of unity culminates with the blessing at the conclusion of the service. And we evolved this over the years at Lake O'Hara. And we imagined at the front, in the very middle, in the front, according to the geometry, we imagined that a bowl of reception where the Chirag would give the blessing. In this case, the photograph on the left is when Hiddayat was giving his sermon. the photograph on the right, again by Falzonisa, is how Hidayat looked when he was giving the blessing. He didn't always participate. He sometimes was in the audience watching and giving us some direction and thoughts about the way it was being handled. But this is what it would have looked like had he when he was giving the blessing. So I just wanted to quickly talk about the legacy of the living altar. One example here, I'll just read a little bit here. In the caves of Cuba, a group of Sufis joined with the shaman, Panchito, and his daughter, Idealis, for a tobacco ceremony and prayers in 2009. Here in the depths of the earth, where the indigenous people had hidden from the Spaniards' dark genocide, they joined in prayer with one of the last living Indian elders in the country. And I was just asking, Sophia Carol Sill just sent me this information last week, but I was talking to Joe about that, Korean Joe Clare, and he was saying that even, well, back in 2009, they had to have this ceremony in the cave, the protective cave, because even back then, the native people were not allowed to express their spirituality publicly. They couldn't do it. They had to do it secretly and away from the prying eyes of the government. So an impromptu universal worship was held in the cave. Different people held a candle for each major world religion. An English yogi held the Hindu candle. A woman from China carried the Buddhist light. An Afro-Cuban woman, a Jewish man, and young Cuban Christian woman with a Canadian Sufi held the light for Islam. The light of truth was held by a Cuban man. And an Argentinian yoga teacher held the light of God. And after this ceremony, they left a cigar, the tobacco offering, a cigar burning beside a candle on the ledge in the cave, and a little cassava, which is a food offering, offering before they climbed back up into the sunlight. So the universal, the living altar was a wonderful ceremony to sort of bring together the Sufis and the indigenous tradition in Cuba. But it's also being held in other places. I recently got pictures of the living altar being held in Ecuador. You can see it's more formal there, but the spirit of it is it comes right from Lake O'Hara. I think it was guided by Pir Nawab, and they're very devoted and dedicated in Ecuador. It was beautiful. In the summer school in 1993, I was asked to attend. I don't actually have a picture of the living altar at the summer school, but this is where it was held, and that was quite it was quite something. And then Ronnie invited me and Nirtan actually to come to Northwest Camp in 2000, and here's a picture of the living altar at the Northwest Camp. It was very beautiful. It was very moving. And this is my last slide. I just wanted to just express not only sort of the devotional aspects. We had a lot of fun at Lake O'Hara as well, and you can see there was a lot of camaraderie. And Hidayat and Aziza were absolutely delightful. This is just sort of a few photo images of some of the activities that took place. We have talent night, which one day we'll have to talk about how how great talent night was. But we've got Ronnie down the bottom left, Ronnie and Luke, and Hamida from who's joining us from Amsterdam. She's in the picture up here. This is Hamida. That's me, and that's Kuan Yin from Banff. And that's one of my daughters there, sitting on Hidayat's lap. And there's Ronnie and Luke. So there's a few years between this one and this one. Anyway, that's it. I leave it now. I will stop the sharing, and perhaps.